You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 26, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, war on that new financial mortgage fraud tax force. Is it a whitewash? Is it a Schneiderman co-optation? What of the other attorney generals? Very interesting interview with Beau Biden on Rattigan yesterday. We'll get into that. Also, great piece by Dean Baker, which I will read in contrast to one by Ezra Klein, which is not to say that Ezra Klein's piece isn't a great piece, but it's interesting. That and more. No guests today, folks. We will take your calls earlier in the program, if you are so inclined, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. I may not even give this to freeloaders. Freeloaders may not even hear this show today. You probably will. And we also have an amazing, you've probably heard this already, but maybe not. There was a case in East Haven, Connecticut, where apparently a group of cops were targeting the Latino community in East Haven, I guess 10% of the population there. And the FBI swooped in, arrested these cops. It's been an ongoing investigation. And the response from the mayor is beyond belief. It's a four-minute clip. We're not going to play it now. A four-minute clip. We'll play it a little bit later in the show. I have listened to it now, I would say close to a dozen times. And I am not tired of it. It is stunning. Just an update in Indiana. As anticipated, the Democrats basically had to come back into session there. They were getting fined $1,000 a day for basically trying to prevent the Indiana House from achieving quorum to pass Mitch Daniels' so-called right-to-work bill. It's really a right-to-work at reduced wages and protections for workers bill. It is the one that says that you're not bound by a unionized contract. You don't have to pay any dues to a union that has negotiated on your behalf and raised your wages and increased your job stability. Just one more attack on unionization in this country. Scott Walker even wouldn't do this because he knows what happens. And I suspect as jobs are added to the auto industry in this country, it's projected that within the next 5 years, another 150,000 jobs will be added to the auto industry in this country. showing the efficacy of what I think was the one of the best things that the Obama administration did, which was the bailout of the auto industry in terms of saving millions upon millions of jobs in this country. I think when those auto workers in Indiana start to see, hey, wait a second, 5-10 years from now, why are the auto workers in Michigan doing so much better? The ones in Illinois, why are they doing so much better? Well, you will find out as time goes on. So that battle will not be waged during the Super Bowl, which is unfortunate. All right, I want to get into this story. We're going to get the mortgage coverage shortly. But Ezra Klein had a piece in Bloomberg, and it's an interesting piece because it speaks to what I think many of the people who listen to this program, not all, why they have such problems with Obama. And that, in fact, is not what Ezra Klein was, why he was writing it. And I was on the Young Turks last night. I guess slightly a wet blanket about the State of the Union. But I think, look, politically speaking, I think that speech was okay. I think it's going to help him. President Obama has every right to be encouraged by at least some of the economic news, and that it may not be disastrous, the economy, by the fall. I'm not so convinced, but and he certainly has rights to be feeling a little good about the competition he's going to be facing. And certainly there were aspects of that speech. We talked about it with David Day, and we don't need to go over this again. But there were aspects of that speech where there was the classic sort of like a deficit hawk language was not in play. But one of the sections of the speech that really bothered me was, of course, his reiteration of his wanting to pursue a grand bargain. Now, it was subtle enough that it doesn't have the rhetorical force that it could have, a damaging force. And we know that the Republicans in the House are not going to pass anything, even if it's in their best interests, if Obama is signed on board to this. So it was this piece of audio in the State of the Union that bothered me the most. Let's play this here.
I'm a Democrat, but I believe what Republican Abraham Lincoln believed. The government should do for people only what they cannot do better by themselves and no more.
I'll drop it a little bit here during this applause, because we don't need to hear the applause here. Now, of course, both sides are applauding on this. And I have no problem with this statement. Of course, I agree with this. But where you draw that line is really the issue. What can individuals do better than government can do? And vice versa. He continues.
That's why my education reform offers more competition and more control for schools and states.
Pause it. Now, this idea of competition, I think there should be accountability in education. But again, this rhetorically, I'm just judging this based on rhetoric now. Understand that that was one of the reasons why I supported President Obama, or I was encouraged, I should say, by President Obama in 2008. I didn't think that he was going to be able to fix many of the problems that we have, because 4 years, just simply not enough time. But rhetorically speaking, I thought he would make an argument. This is rhetoric weak tea, to cite Arnie Duncan's continuance of the Bush-Kennedy No Child Left Behind. Because I think, frankly, Race to the Top is a loser. And he went on to say later, the way that we judge teachers, we should not be judging the efficacy of teachers based upon test scores, which force students to which force teachers to teach to the test. But that's not the issue. I digress. This part of what he says next really bothers me.
That's why we're getting rid of regulations that don't work. That's why our health care law relies on a reformed private market, not a government program.
All right, end it right there. There is not a single shred of evidence, and candidate Barack Obama knew this, that private markets can handle health insurance better than public insurance. There are 40, 50, maybe more, million Americans who are on public health insurance. Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA actually is not just public health insurance, it's public medicine. There is not one shred of evidence, not one reason to believe that the private health insurance system is more effective than the public health insurance system. Costs are better contained in terms of the delivery of medicine in the public system. Medicare rate of growth expenses is much less than private. We know that Medicare is significantly more efficient. 3 cents of every dollar goes to the administration of Medicare insurance versus 25 cents on the dollar in the private industry. And President Obama knew this when he was a candidate. He said he would rather single payer. He just didn't think we were culturally ready for it. But here he is making a different argument. I agree with him that government need not do what the private markets can do better. But health insurance is not one of those things, nor is disaster relief, nor is building national highway system or building a national train system. It's just not in the interest. Look at that Rachel Maddow commercial, if you want the argument right there, the Hoover Dam. And so Ezra Klein has this piece in Bloomberg where he says, where he writes, to listen to the two candidates, the 2012 election is an epical clash between irreconcilable worldviews. It is an alliance against the empire, elves versus the orcs, et cetera, et cetera. They're right about one thing. The 2012 election matters a lot. The winning party will reap political benefits. But as for the ideological showdown of the century stuff, it's overblown. The two likely presidential nominees would, if elected, pursue very different economic philosophies and domestic policies, but not nearly as different as they would have you believe. Romney makes it sound as if he's running against Vladimir Lenin, but what has Barack Obama done or proposed to do? He continued the Bush administration's rescue of the financial system and auto industry. He passed a health care law modeled on reforms Romney passed in Massachusetts. He passed a financial regulation bill that erected protective scaffolding around the banking system, but shied away from fundamentally reshaping it. He wants to extend most, but not all, of the Bush tax cuts. He has insisted that deficit reduction includes some tax increases, though he's willing to accept as many $3 in spending cuts for every dollar in increased taxes. You can disagree with this list without pretending it's radical or somehow inimical to free enterprise. Now, you understand, Ezra Klein is talking to now the establishment. When I hear that list, I get agitated. Ezra Klein is citing that list as a way of comforting his audience. And he writes, capitalism will survive as efforts to use market-based means to accomplish traditional liberal ends. And he goes on to state that both parties were involved in financial deregulation and that the health care bill has its roots in Republican proposals. And he goes on to say that Education Secretary Arne Duncan wants to mend, not end, No Child Left Behind. The Affordable Care Act strengthened Bush's Medicare Part D. He goes on to say, this is not an attempt, and this is for you, this is for my audience. This is he's covering his left flank here, or I should say his right flank. This is not an attempt to extend the foolish critique that there is no difference between the two parties or the two likely presidential nominees. It matters that Obama's proposed tax cuts amount to $3 trillion and benefit taxpayers making less than $250, while Romney's would cost more than $6 trillion and are tilted toward the top 1%. That's a function. Now, what he's talking about there is that there is some redistributive philosophies that are slightly different. There are some mitigating. The tax code can, in some way, mitigate income inequality. He goes on to say, it matters that Obama would implement the Affordable Care Act and Romney would try to appeal it. It matters that Obama is inclined to strengthen the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau while Republicans want to weaken it. I don't know how much it matters in these instances, frankly. But let's leave that debate aside. You know why I am supportive of Obama over Romney. Supreme Court. And, frankly, so that it opens up debates just like this one. But he says, but the 2012 election is not an epochal clash of irreconcilable worldviews. And he said the two parties are much further apart politically than they are philosophically. Now, when I hear this, it makes me upset. This is Ezra Klein speaking to his audience to try and calm them down. Now, I think Ezra is good at policy, but I think he's coming from a very different perspective. He says, which explains both the reality behind the reasons for the apocalyptic rhetoric. In their effort to isolate Obama, deny him the bipartisan cooperation, the Republicans have made these broad philosophical distinctions. He says, if anything is truly on trial in 2012, it's not free enterprise, which is firmly supported on both sides of the aisle, or even the social safety net, which isn't going anywhere. It's a political system where you win elections by denying areas of ideological agreement and refusing to participate in corporate governance. Now, I think he doesn't quite get it. He thinks the political system is broken. And the evidence of this is that the people attempt to win elections by denying areas of ideological agreement and refusing to participate in cooperative governance. But what I think Ezra Klein doesn't understand is this is a feature, not a bug. That this is a way in which the establishment maintains policies that are good for the establishment. Ezra Klein does not see this. But the fact of the matter is, if there was a broader sense of ideological agreement, as Ezra Klein says, the anger that we see in Occupy Wall Street or on the streets or in the polls that show people are upset about income disparity would be even greater and would have come even earlier. And I would also argue that, frankly, I'm not so convinced that the Republicans haven't even moved that much further to the right than Ezra Klein is capable of acknowledging. Because the Romney that he keeps citing is a Romney completely disavowed by Romney. And there's no reason to believe that Romney's going to return to that Romney. But be that as it may, the differences that Ezra Klein cites in terms of tax policy and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And tax cuts and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Dean Baker has a great piece. I think it's in Al Jazeera English. And he briefly responds to Thomas Edsel, who is a very well-accomplished political observer, who had a column in the New York Times, where Edsel said, the difference between conservatives and liberals is the extent over which they are willing to reverse market outcomes to redistribute money from winners to losers. Now, understand, we're in this sort of like gray area now where there are semantics. But as Fran Lebowitz says, the problem with liberals is money. And Edsel wrote, the two sides are fighting over what the role of government in redistributing resources from the affluent to the needy should and shouldn't be. In other words, what should be the top marginal tax rates? That's the same argument that Ezra Klein cites, correct? They're tax policies, which ultimately is a determinant of the redistributive function of government. And then perhaps are you going to add 15, 20, 30 million people to 13 million people to the Medicare rolls? Are you going to add another 20 million people with health insurance? Dean Baker writes, anyone trying to understand the role of government in the economy should know that whatever it does or does not do by way of redistribution is trivial compared with the actions it takes to determine the initial distribution. In other words, this is what I've been saying for a long time. Government, by its very nature, by its very existence, picks winners and losers. He goes on to say, rich people don't get rich exclusively by virtue of their talents and hard work. And I would add luck. They get rich because the government has made rules to allow them to get rich. Government always picks winners and losers. The mere existence of an organization of society picks winners and losers. Merit does not exist in nature. If you're a good hunter, you'll get more food. That's true. If you're a good gatherer, you'll get more berries. If you're a good grower, you'll get more crops. But as we know, that barter never existed in an economy. Until the absence of currency. Everything after that has to do with the way that society is structured as to whether or not you accumulate things, power, money. And so Dean Baker goes on to cite some examples. He says, an obvious one is, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, we spend close to $300 billion a year on prescription drugs. If drugs were sold in a free market without government-granted patent monopolies, we would spend about $30 billion a year. So by the fact that government allows for patents to be held and held and held, it allows the drug companies to jack up their prices. He says, the difference of $270 billion a year is more than five times as much money as is at stake with extending the Bush tax cuts to the wealthy. And he concedes, we need a way to finance drug research because you need to have these patents. They need to exist forever because otherwise, you know, Pfizer's not going to put money into research. He says there are far more efficient mechanisms than patent monopolies to provide funds for drug research. And we also know these drug companies could simply rejigger the amount of profits that they take. These are wildly profitable companies. He says there are far more efficient mechanisms than patent monopolies that do not redistribute income upwards in the same way. And by upwards, he means when that $270 billion that is paid to pharmaceutical companies as a function of the government protecting their patents registered with the government. It's not property. They can keep their property. They can keep their drugs. But it's a government decision that says that we're going to create property out of an idea or a recipe that others can follow. That doesn't exist in nature. And that money goes to the CEO and then to the board of directors and the shareholders, and it goes up to rich people. In a similar vein, he writes, our policy on labor unions is incredibly one-sided in management's favor. If a company illegally fires a worker for trying to organize a union, the complaint would go to the National Labor Relations Board. It's likely to take months and possibly years before that complaint is settled. Even if the worker can prove their case, employers rarely admit that they fired someone because they were organizing a union, the fine to that company is trivial. As a result, breaking the law and getting rid of agitators can be very profitable for the company. On the other hand, if workers stage a strike that violates the law, for example, a wildcat strike at a time when a contract is in force, or a secondary strike in support of other workers, this would be a violation of Taft-Hartley, a company can typically get an injunction immediately. If the workers continue their strike, their assets will be seized and their leaders thrown in jail. We are picking winners and losers there. We are allowing the state to bring bear up its monopoly on force, as my libertarian friends would say, on behalf of the corporation. Corporations don't exist in nature. They are entities that are created by the existence of government. Unions also don't exist in nature. But if this was just, if there was no corporations and unions and just a company and workers, where do you think the power balance would be then? That's pitchforks time. That's not just the guys who are working for your company. That's their brother-in-laws and their mothers, I guess, and their cousins and their uncles. They'll all mess with that company. Which is why, of course, we have Taft-Hartley, right? To prevent labor from really gathering together. And so Dean Maker makes this point that redistribution through taxes, while important, is small bore. And the president's not doing any favors on that accord. Now, understand that, you know, Dean Baker's position there, I think, is probably arguably to the left of liberals, or at least in terms of rhetorically. We do not hear liberals playing on that field. And that is the field we should be playing on. That's why I spend so much time knocking back libertarianism. Aside from the fact that it's fantastical, those notions that somehow we need a free market and that a free market exists is a lie. And it's a lie that needs to be exposed constantly. Government is constantly picking winners and losers. Everything is set up to pick winners and losers. There's no other way to do it. It's just a question of which winners and which losers you pick. And in this government, and in this day and age, in our system today, you are the loser. Labor is the loser. The 99% is the loser. You'll see, you know, capital gains taxes, incidentally, are scheduled to go up by 2013. The Tax Policy Center put out a piece that shows that assuming the Affordable Care Act is not repealed, and assuming the Bush tax cuts are not extended, capital gains by, I believe this is going to be 2013, would be up to 25%, where they should be. They should be even higher, I think. I mean, I like President Obama's idea of if you're making over $1 million a year, your effective tax rate should be 30%. You get charitable deductions, that's it, 30%. It's like a flat tax for millionaires. Great. They keep complaining about the complexity of the tax code. Let the millionaires deal with it. You can get it. It'll be very simple, 30%. But that's just the beginning. Because power in this country is distributed in many different ways by our government, and it's distributed upward. Which brings us to the financial investigative task force, whatever they're calling it. I can't even tell. We spoke to David Dayan about this yesterday, and there's been some activity since then. You remember the issue is that now that Schneiderman is on board with this, what are the implications? Are the other AGs going to sign on board with Schneiderman? Are they going to sign on board to the deal that the federal government is pushing? Well, we have some evidence. Remember, there's five AGs that were the holdouts. Schneiderman, Beau Biden from Delaware, Kamala Harris from California. You've also got Martha Coakley in Massachusetts and the Attorney General of Nevada. Did I say that right? Nevada? I can't remember her name. But here is Beau Biden on Dylan Radigan's show yesterday. And there's three segments I want to listen to. He is not signing off on this deal. And if you listen to these three segments, I think you get a notion of what he thinks about Schneiderman joining this task force. Nobody else has commented on this because David Dayan had a piece today, and he actually put up this video too, I noticed. But nobody's commented that Biden seems fairly suspicious of what Schneiderman's doing. But listen to this. Who knows? Here's the first one.
But here's the issue. I'm a prosecutor. Anytime I'm prosecuting somebody, they need to know that I'm more eager to get to the bottom of the facts than they are, and that I will. The situation we've had here, quite frankly, and this goes across all party lines and a whole host of entities, that the other side, that specifically the two big to fail banks, believe, this is me just speaking, believe that many of us on the enforcement side are as scared or more scared than they are of peeling back this onion. If you start these investigations with the other side, in this case, the two big to fail banks, believing that we are as or more scared about peeling back the onion as they are, that's a fundamental, fundamental problem. And that's why you see courageous attorneys general like Catherine Cortez Masto, Nevada, Martha Coakley in Massachusetts, to name two, who are actually are doing something. You know, we need to act here. Words are nice, but they really are getting kind of old here. We need to act and investigate, file cases, file complaints, seek indictments. If the facts take us there, we need to act. That's what people are sick and tired of, us talking about this.
Okay, so
you're nodding.
Absolutely. I mean, turn it down. That's okay, so he's named two people there. He goes on to say why he will not sign on to this deal as it is. Because they're getting the U.S. deal that the Obama administration has been pushing basically allows the banks basically cop to robo-signing, to MERS, which is low-hanging fruit. but they get released from liability for all the other more serious stuff. And here's Biden on that. This is number three.
It doesn't get to the bottom of the facts. Look, you cannot, when you're investigating things, give away, that is, allow the party you're opposing to plead to the easiest issue. That is, take the plea on the easy crime before you've investigated the big crimes. My analogy, you've heard me before, Dylan, is that this is like a consumer protection case. You can analogize it to criminal cases or consumer protection. Consumer protection analogy, you cannot have a situation where you say in a home improvement scheme that, look, I know you've got us on the wiring. And you know you've got us on that. But we also built the foundation. We also built the roof. And, we also have other problems. We'll settle for you on the wiring issue, but but as long as you settle on the roof and foundation and you give us a plea on that. You just can't do investigations that way where you give away the one. Look, this is the one thing that the banks have admitted to on the servicing side. How do you let them take a plea or a settlement to that before you've gotten to the bigger stuff?
So next up, here's Biden basically finally saying, I'm not going to be, well, there's two things. There's three things in this. One, he sounds like a guy who's still going to be pursuing these investigations. Two, he says, I want to know this task force that President Obama announced that Schneiderman has signed on to. I want to know what the resources are, which implies that Schneiderman doesn't know what the resources are. And thirdly, he once again cites the work of its fellow AGs, but there's a name missing.
Phil banks simply don't believe we have the guts to get to the bottom of this. And I'll tell you, if my little office, we're going to keep plugging away on this. Catherine Mastow is going to keep plugging away on this. You're going to see Kamala Harris continue her hard work on this. You're going to see Martha Coakley, none of whom I speak for, but all of whom I respect, continue to work on this. And you're going to, and I applaud the president's comments last night and the resolve to continue investigations. My question's on the investigations, and I've asked my federal partners this. I'll be a part of the task force. But the questions I have is, how many FBI agents are you going to put on it? How many investigators are you going to put on it? How many prosecutors are you going to put on it? Those are the hard scrabble questions I have. I told those folks that I'm willing to work with them on this, and I'm happy to do it, and I hope we'll get somewhere on this.
Now, I have read stuff. I have read stuff that has suggested that Schneiderman has a plan. I have read stuff that has been skeptical as a plan. But Bo Biden doesn't seem terribly pleased with this. There was a name missing from that list of attorney generals who were the big holdouts from that deal. He doesn't even reference Schneiderman. I don't know. I found that a little bit strange and a little bit disturbing. But on the upside, Kamala Harris also came out yesterday and said national mortgage deal still not good for California. Remember, David Dayan told us that her brother-in-law is sitting on that task force with Schneiderman. So there's some pressure there. And they had promised $8 billion to California. But Kamala Harris announced that she still refuses to join the national foreclosure settlement. We reviewed the details of the latest settlement proposal from the banks. We believe it's inadequate for California. A state has been clear about what any multi-state settlement must contain: transparency, relief going to the distressed homeowners, and meaningful enforcement that ensures accountability. So basically, what that means is how much get out, what for this payment, what's the get out of free jail card they're going to get? How much can we continue to investigate? And David Dayan yesterday expressed some dismay at how sort of quickly left-leaning groups had fallen in line with this deal. But today, he has a piece up just came up right before the show. Although it says 7:35 a.m. Oh, that's, I think that's Pacific. Russ Feingold's group, Progressives United, was skeptical. Color of Change is skeptical. The New York Times, skeptical in an editorial piece. Schneiderman apparently has announced that he is not signing on to the settlement, but it remains to be seen. We will dig into this as the days continue on. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we will head into the better half of the program, wherein I will play that audio of the mayor. You cannot miss this. Folks, every now and then I turn on my TV and watch what passes for news. And I'm not just talking about CNN. I watch other channels too. And sometimes I'm impressed, and other times I'm just blown away at how ridiculous and stupid the analysis and how shallow it is, and how it's been ripped off a fax machine, et cetera, et cetera. And then I look, and I see what a nice set they have, what a nice suit they have. And I say, why don't we have more members? I say that out loud. And then my daughter looks at me and she goes, what are you talking about? And I say, why aren't you in bed? And she says, I can't sleep. And I said, you haven't tried. And she says, I'm scared. And I said, no, you're not. You're lying. And she goes, okay, but I don't want to go to bed now. Can I just watch more? I don't want to get into that whole conversation. The point is, folks, if you can afford to become a member, please do. There are thousands upon thousands of you who listen to this show, unless separate groups of thousands of people show up every day. It's quite possible that the universe of our audience is five times larger than I think it is. But I find that hard to believe. I think most of you are listening to the show 3 days a week at least. And if you're listening to the show 3 days a week, why not support it? I'm not going to say names anymore. I'm not going to get myself in trouble. I'm not going to foreclose any of those opportunities more than I already have. But do you really want to rely on those people for your news? What are you going to do? I mean, if Chris Hayes had a show 5 days a week, I could understand it. But he doesn't. So become a member. You can join us in the better half of the show, which will start in just a moment.